Hi, it's Sunday afternoon, and it's time for another Wordplay. I'm your host, Jeff Davis. Joining me today in the studio, Sebastian Matthews, my co-host, my esteemed co-host. And today we've got something really, really quite special. We've got a live reading by Sebastian Matthews earlier this year at UNCG in Greensboro, right after the introduction of his new book, or when it was still then, the new book, We Generous.
Yeah, I'm excited about this reading because in response to an essay by Major Jackson about race and poetry, I tried out reading poems about jazz and race while playing some records, and it was a good audience, and we'll play that. It takes about 35 minutes, and then when that's over, we're going to go to some really special recordings as well of an old teacher of mine, Dick Barnes, who died back in 2000. He was a California poet. These are songs that he's singing, some of his own, some traditional, some mixed. And he basically dies a couple months after this, so it's really his voice is weak, but you can hear so much richness in his knowledge and his love of song. So we'll listen to some Dick Barnes recorded in his house by Patrick Breyer in February 2000 to end off the show.
Play music a lot tonight, and can you guys hear me okay? And I'll explain why up front, and then I will see how it goes. A couple things have engaged me lately. One of them is an article by a friend of mine, the poet Major Jackson, and he wrote it in the American Poetry Review, and I'm not sure if you've seen it. It's a great piece, but it's basically an article that challenges white poets to write more about race. And I think he's right. I don't think many white poets do. And so I've been thinking a lot about that piece. I printed it out and I've been reading it. And I've also been thinking about some of my students lately came up to me and said, why do you write about jazz? It's so uncool. It's so dorky. It's been done. Stop doing it. They're really embarrassed for me. And I had to explain kind of why I do it. And my explanation is I can't help it. But then when I started reading this piece, I became aware that I know that I've been trying to write about race for the last few years, but I think that maybe my vehicle for doing it, for good and for bad, is jazz music. I grew up listening to it and inherited my father's records. And I go to a lot of live jazz. And so I thought, well, maybe that's what I'm trying to do. And also, a long time ago, in the life of my poetry, 5 or 6 years ago, I ran into a poem by a friend of mine. I hadn't known him at the time, but I read the poem, and it kind of blew me away. It's a poem called Notes of a Southpaw. And I'm going to read you some of that poem now. And it was the first poem to challenge me to try to write about race as well. So what I thought I'd do tonight was read poems about jazz and about trying to figure out how to function in this country in its current state, and see how that goes. And I'm going to read you first a paragraph from this article by Major Jackson. And he writes, all this to say, in a country whose professional strength is best observed in its plurality of cultures, what seems odd to me, and this I find most appalling about contemporary American poetry, is the dearth of poems written by white poets that address racial issues, that chronicle our struggle as a democracy, to find tranquility and harmony as a nation containing many nations. Why is this? How is that poetry does not reflect and serve as a record of the evolution of our racial attitudes, and progress much like American fiction, from Harriet Beecher Stowe's Uncle Tom's Cabin to Philip Roth's The Human Stain? Well, it does to some extent, but the canon is severely lopsided and asymmetrical, and without that complete, wide-ranging, and far-reaching racial dialogue as a literary and cultural legacy reflected in our poetry, discussions of race and ethnicity will forever be a spectator sport. Stolen Moments, a great tune. I'm going to read you a poem called High Wire Act. It comes out of this book, We Generous. And it's kind of a prelude to a longer poem that I'm going to try to read in its entirety in the middle of this reading. High Wire Act, McCabe's Guitar Shop, Los Angeles, 1989. We're in line for James Blood Ulmer, the crowd mostly white guys like us. Seth nods knowingly as if he knows the night will bloom into another dimension, the way the kids outside dead shows walk around with fingers in the air chanting, "I need a miracle." Inside, the lean young drummer is polyphonic like Elvin Jones. He ignores the crowd, blasting away in a whirlwind of kicks and strikes, brushes and swipes, the bassist off on an island of melody, painting watercolors plein air, climbing up mountains, lost in dark caves of pulse and groove. Ulmer's in the corner, part Hendrix, part Sphere Monk, laying out jagged melodic lines, quirky guitar licks. The crowd, quiet, awkward, reverent, abashed, cool. Everyone patting their back for making this scene. The band's restless, not impressed, happy at break to climb up rickety stairs to the dressing room, another lost night, play out the next set, and move on. A long hour, and the drummer comes down alone, starts in building a sandcastle of rhythms, a Taj Mahal of beats that says, "Fuck it, I'll do what I want, you don't know what to ask for." Then, this, have to say it, this dumb white guy stands up and starts clapping along with what? One of the drummer's rhythms? Not even that. He's clapping inside the music, out of time, loud, like a teenager alone in a mansion, fingering his lighter. I turn to Seth, aghast, and he's staring too, the drummer furious in his hands. Ulmer stalks the stage, tightroping its scuffed edge, then walks right up to this moron, clapping, and plays chords that shout, "Sit down, dumbass!" And I'm shouting in my head, "Stop it, stop it, stop it," but he keeps clapping. The drum solo now, calamitous cacophony. Jumping up from the kit, the drummer bellows through a megaphone of hurt, flicking his sticks, not into the crowd or at the man's head, but into the wings, and they clatter like empty beer cans tossed down an alley. I've been shot in the chest. The bass player unplugs. Ulmer plays a few choruses of Send in the Clowns and puts down his guitar, night over. Live at the Village Vanguard. Near the end of Bill Evans's Porgy, I Loves You, Porgy, played live at the Village Vanguard and added as an extra track on Waltz for Debbie, a session made famous by the death of the trio's young bassist in a car crash, a woman laughs. There's been background babble bubbling up the whole set. You get used to the voices percolating at the song's fringes, the clink of glasses and chips of silver on hard plates. Listen to the recording enough, and you almost accept the oral clutter as another percussive trick the drummer pulls out, like brushes on a snare. But this woman's voice stands out for its carefree audacity, how it broadcasts the lovely ascending stare of her happiness. Evans has just made one of his elegant, casual flights up an octave and rests on its landing, notes spilling from his left hand like sunlight, before coming back down into the tune's lush living room of conclusion. The laugh begins softly, subsides, then lifts up to step over the bass line, five short bursts of pleasure pushed out of what can only be a long, lovely, tan throat. Maybe Evans smiles to himself when he hears it, leaving a little space between the notes he's cobbled to close the song. Maybe the man she's with leans in, first to still her from the laugh he's just coaxed from her, then to caress the cascade of her hair that hangs, lace curtain, in the last vestiges of spotlight stippling the table. In this piece, Major asks a couple questions about why white poets may not write about race. He's not really attacking, he's just... I mean, it's a pretty strong attack, but it's not without reason and without intelligence. And one of the things he says or asks, in a sense, is why not? Why aren't white poets writing about race? And he asked a bunch of white poets who basically say, and it's a list. Well, they don't want to cause discomfort in the reader. Others point out a lack of encounter and experience with non-white people, feeling they would not authoritatively contribute much in the discussion of race relations. And others say, believing about race is opportunistic and disingenuous, for it is not a white issue, but an issue for black people and other people of color. These are all reasons why people don't do it. While others fear embarrassment and the negative reaction of friends and strangers, once again envisioning a liberal-minded and retributive readership that would conduct a virtual public lynching. And the list goes on. Then he says, I think the most interesting statement, many white contemporary poets do not have black friends. Or if they do enjoy the bonds and frustrations of friendship with people of other races, those poems are not being written. Rather, many poems about race capture encounters with people of color. These poems normally take place in public, on a street corner or a job site. And I realized that I'm guilty of that myself. I've written a bunch of poems about encountering other people, people of different class, different race, that's a way in, but maybe it's not everything. So I thought I'd read you a new poem that may be guilty of what he's saying, but it's a road trip poem, so there's a lot of reason for it there. It's called Detour Ahead, and it's set in, you'll notice, it's set in Philly, not my city, but here it goes. One week alone on campus spoiled us to everything real in the world, but a heightened camaraderie, quick to reach fever pitch, writers at conference. We stopped only to eat on scheduled beat and to sleep, restless skiffs in the boathouse of dreams. Huddling in clusters, we chatted into the night about everything process. How could so much fun be so exhausting? I've left it now, thank God, a few hours out of Raleigh, mind unspooling the truth serum pontification a workshop tends to extract from its leader. About to fall asleep inside this numb corridor of I-95, what the hell, I turn down the potholed off-ramp into the trough of Philadelphia. Just my luck. The Phillies are at home, and I'm stalled dead center inside the stadium parking crush, bumping forward inch by maddening inch. The radio announces if they lose, the Phils have accrued 10,000 losses. Some fan's punched gut of a stat. I don't care, wanting only the traffic to open up, which, when broad parts its tributary mouth to kiss the wooden teeth of this old city, it eventually does. I've got Evans's explorations on the deck, LaFaro's groove pulse carrying me through the afternoon. Murals and storefronts and center lane parked cars. One homeless soul pushing the world's shopping cart brimming with crushed cans. Two blocks and I'm in the land of Starbucks and skyscrapers. Men in suits, women in pairs walking fast. There's enough coffee in my system to stun gun an elephant. There's a square, a wrong turn, and for a few lost minutes, one-way streets send me around in circles. The route looks straight enough on the map, a simple drive up into pastoral green. I was hoping Highway 611 would escort me up its urban spine into the river-lined, weedy heart of rural America. Rolling down my window to ask an elderly couple, am I still on Broad? Will it take me out of the city? The man throws me a look that says, you know where you're headed, white boy? Then he nods, just keep going straight. I want to tell him that the same year, LaFaro recorded Detour Ahead with Evans and Motion on drums. Possibly the most synchronized trio ever. He also played on Ornette's Free Jazz, that ultimate firework of an album, before wrapping his young man's Firebird around a tree 6 months later on New York State Route 20 outside Geneva, which is like orchestrating a game-ending double play, then preparing the five-star meal that night at some hot new bistro, saucepans exploding into mini bonfires of applause. Then, tented by a box of cardboard, marinated in piss and dirt, sleeping on a grate, passersby's agree to overlook. A friend's first night in Philly, he's driving down Broad in a rental truck, worried by the conspicuous absence of streetlights, run-down buildings leaning in like field oaks, when he comes upon a car on fire. No one around, no police, windows rolled down, he takes in the burning rubber, the crackling heat off the pyre. Me, I'm the only white face in a square mile, a white boy bubbled by cool jazz, wide awake now, thank you, absorbing as much as I can, open to the heat, the city's talk, squabbling with the music. Then, when the road bends, I'm in the suburbs, just like that, the long snake of sprawl, pod mall after pod mall, first one township, then another, up in the country now, a green chant of trees, river dancing in and out of sight, small bridges popping brief drum solos under my tires. Pretty soon, I'm in the long, cool embrace of the Delaware Gap, breeze washing my face, heading northeast to 84. Evans is my foolish heart, subsumed in light. Rush of wind, tires whirring inside a brush snare, the day suddenly mine, body resurrected inside each windshield frame moment, catching them like fish in its porous net. I was listening to an old record, and I realized after about 5 minutes that the drum solo was continuing on, and then I realized about 5 minutes later it continued to keep going on, and I realized it was like a 10-minute drum solo in the middle of a 12-minute song, and I played it over again. I thought, damn, I've never heard that before. And it's Eddie Locke is the drummer's drum, is his drum solo, and it's, the song was Caravan. And so this poem is called Eddie Locke's Drum Solo on Caravan, Alive at the Village Gate. There's a point somewhere in the middle of the desert of Locke's drum solo, say 4 minutes in, when you realize you've not only lost track of the melody, but could care less about melody. All song for that matter, that for a while you've been inhabiting a lengthy sonic lecture on history, beginning with the original Malayan rhythms and sticking his way on up past big band propulsion, looping back in long loping lines, jump rope skiffs and large playground swings through time, Dolly's warp clocks and the suspended water cat, holding back the all-star band from its last round of solos, moving way past decorum, playfully expanding the repertoire of moves and touches as a way to say, I can play it all, baby, and watch me do it. If you can find that, you should listen to it. It's pretty amazing. When the Ken Burns series Jazz came out, a lot of people watched it and loved it, as I did. But a lot of jazz fans hated it for some good reasons. They were pissed at it for being so straight. It didn't really incorporate any too much of the avant-garde music. It seemed to kind of just focus too much on the mainstream stuff. And but there's a great moment when you see Louis Armstrong performing. I don't know about you, but I'd never seen him perform young before as a young man. I was pretty much blown away by him. And you should go check it out if you haven't seen it. This is a poem called Louis Armstrong Performing I Cover the Waterfront. Watching, jaw-dropped, Louis Armstrong sing I Cover the Waterfront with his young man's strut, his front man's bravado and grace, a one and a two. Entranced as he jumps into the opening chorus, like a bullfighter stepping into potentially beautiful disaster, the band behind him bristling with readiness. What is it he's got? What about the man makes me lean forward expectantly? Nothing flashy at first, nothing special, only perfect time, a master's casual confidence. Not until the second chorus, that is, and then stop, back up, there. See behind his eyes? Something switches on. He's both folding inward away from the camera and turning on for it. Now he's utterly alive with it, with joyous, naughty, jaunting, knowing, body animated with its force. One hand is at his side, folded back in sassy woman pantomime, the other pumping the down-face horn in frantic syncopation. His head askew, chin thrust forward, eyes scrunched tight, then thrown open. It's like he's his own instrument, his solo voice parading out from behind his white teeth in lisping spurts, like he's conjuring a young Billie Holiday out of thin air, putting up some circus poster image for her, of her, for her to burst through years later, fully formed as Lady Day, like he's dreaming this world better than it ever should be. When he's done singing, come back from his high place, done shape-shifting, he steps back from the mic, only to circle back, strutting again, on the prowl, a lion, a king, and back now, presto, horn to lips, to one-up himself, to lay out hard pearls of sound, and bounce through the mid-tempo number with the slow assurance of a fake here, and out. Big brash car, the band ticks down. Louis steps back into his brawn, and I fall back into my bag of bones. What am I going to do now? I'm going to read you the beginning and the part of the middle and some of the end of this poem, Notes of a Southpaw by Van Jordan. He used to teach here. He's going to read here, I think, next year. He's an amazing man, a great teacher, and a great poet. And this poem really was a poem that woke me up and asked me to write different poetry, for better or for worse. And it's called Notes from a Southpaw. And it starts like this. Date, Monday, March 25th, 1996, just another day in D.C. And I drink with a friend in Georgetown after work. I'm killing a couple hours before I hear Toni Morrison deliver her Jefferson lecture at the Kennedy Center. Inside the crossing guard bar, the white bartender and all his white patrons watch the afterglow of O.J.'s civil case. A white guy in a gray suit sidles up next to me. He holds his drink in his left, the cigarette in his right. The TV switches now to the news of the AIDS-related death of rapper Eazy-E. My friend is not white, Iranian, and I'm the only black in this bar in Chocolate City. It goes from there. It's a pretty loaded situation, and it blows up. And before it blows up, before he beats the shit out of the guy, he says, it's I think one of the perfect questions in poetry, what would Portier do in a situation like this? And he asks another question, what does a man say when he doesn't want to erupt, but he still wants to act like a man? And that question was a question that I loved, but I didn't know, I had no experience of it. And that was when I began to realize that maybe I needed to find a way to ask a similar kind of question from where I stood, somewhere on the other side of that issue. And I'll stop there. I have the book here if you want to read the poem after the reading.
Forgive me, I have to destroy this. This is Coltrane, Mellow Coltrane. And I'm really going to read this poem, Be Generous. It's in 10 parts. They're all about the same length. And the poem begins with an epigraph from that poem, that very question. What does a man say when he doesn't want to erupt, but still wants to act like a man? We generous. Long past midnight, hard rain. Somewhere 20, 30 blocks west the downtown Chicago grid, in a neighborhood taxis don't come to or stop in this late. In search of the sublime, gawkers at the Velvet Lounge, Soul Hole wedged alongside Fitzy's Famous. Fresh out of two epic sets, avant-garde jazz played wildly but seriously by a cabal of young lions gathered around their graybeard leader. Saturated down through our jackets, laughing about it, falling into a kind of sad sack parody of a gang strut. I want to say a bunch of white guys, but that's not exactly it. Comrades, then, ecstatic encounterers of rain-slicked streets, eager to inhabit this one particular moment, whole-souled and sad. Picture it, hovering there at the outer rim of the inner circle of regulars clustered at the bar. We're hip enough to recognize when the bartender puts him on Tatum. His slalom runs and storm pitch arpeggios a kind of sped-up Bud Powell. Hip enough to order drinks wiped clean of class, to clap in the right places, though it ain't easy anticipating the step-back pause inside the baritone's circular breathing. Chords spraying from a hawkshot horn, leg propped on the stage like a trapdoor hinge. One song bleeds into the next. Drummers switching mid-bridge and a flute player sitting in, only white guy on stage who screams into his flute an extended riff on the absence of beauty. Bass pulsing triple time, clanging like at a railroad crossing, horns knocking together like boxcars. Remember that little lunch place on Franklin? How we stepped into that L.A. oven to find Peter's tiny VW bookended by cop cars? Bad omen, I said. I choose, Peter said, to see it as they're looking out for my best interest. Which I assume he meant spiritually, a kind of black man's sarcastic prayer against indirect malice. You read a poem that night about being called a nigger by a white man with a bar stool for a handshake. How at great cost you beat him into submission. The lone black man in the audience coming up to shake your hand, saying he could relate. Later, in Leimert Park, it's me with the bullseye on my chest. You leaned in to remark on vertigo, how it can overtake you when you're out of your element. Elvis on the lunch joint radio. You gave me this look that dropped on the counter heavy into the cup of your hands. I saw you trying but failing to inhabit the world in a manner akin to prayer. Let's not forget, this country has always enjoyed its minstrel show. Even better when the black face is invisible and the man shimmying on stage isn't that hit parade of soul, but some country white boy with hips like a girl's and soulful eyes any mom would melt for. I kept drifting, following the birds' choppy path through sun-gutted windows. They seemed first to fly through a fence, then morph into schooling fish, shivering in a landscape of blue. There was this movie you stayed up late for, ringing your mind's backdoor bell. In it, this white-collar guy dreams he finds God crouched in a dingy closet, in a building at the heart of a city on fire, Dresden or Los Angeles, and though he has the head of a lion, God is scared. The man must take his hand to reassure him. We catch the last train when the rain refuses to stop playing. This kid in a Bulls jersey, no more than 14, starts right in. He sneers, "You Irish?" Then, "You white folks are crazy." Then, with the comic's timing, "Get me a fucking job." There's anger there, but bluffs mostly what I see. Too tired to harass him back or move to another seat, I merely smile. It's a calm resignation that cities bring. The next morning, the storm will sweep through, leaving the streets wet, schoolgirls trundling by in full dress. Beat on our way for coffee, hangovers pulled down like soggy hats, we'll be accosted by a Girl Scout who shouts, "You know you want it." We laugh. We do, and we don't. Maybe our fight is to be awake. Maybe our fight is not to be awake. We're resurrected all the time by fire, but to stay that way. The familiar rocking of the subway carrying us into the next station of night. When did the conversation swerve to the morning's headline slap? Policeman guns down unarmed black man. Same old shit, Peter muttered. I conjured up the image of a madman taking us out, carnival cutouts knocked down, blam, 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 with three twitchy trigger pulls. You remarked, "Man, that's just your white man's guilt urge to go down in flames." You were right. Heading back down 10 the night before in that low-slung sports car, Coltrane, in place of the rap blasted on the way out, I started to say, "I like my anger beautiful," but knew it was a matter up for discussion, and so let the night's bad breath wash me raw. The freeway crowded at midnight, the lights of the inland valley sequencing the night. I thought you'd fallen asleep. You were just taking train in through your pores. There's a story about Art Pepper. Fresh out of jail, he's between everything. Gigs, fixes, horns. Diane arranges a gig, not telling Art, so he wakes to the news. He's playing with Miles' rhythm section. Billy Joe, Garland, Chambers on bass. He's afraid, of course. Hasn't touched his horn in months, cork stuck into its neck and taped in place. Mad at Diane. In awe. They've been playing with Miles. They're masters. He'd been goofing, fixing big before, forgets every song in the book. So Gentleman Red says, "I know a nice tune. Do you know this?" And Art plays it beautiful, chasing after the melody of "You'd Be So Nice to Come Home To." Let's Red call the songs rest of the way. "What should I do at the end?" "Just do a little tag kind of thing." And Art does. They get eight songs on tape. After, she gives him a look that asks, "Happy?" "Yeah, he's happy." Worried, too, he's not played well enough, and proud, bragging up his genius like a cocky boy. The night he falls back into dope, 6 months clean, he tells Diane, "You have to know someone loves you. When you do, everything's easier." Mr. Rhetorical, I once asked you, what is it about this country that makes it hard even to be friends? You could only shake your head. Sitting in the back of Peter's car, Marvin Gaye's "What's Going On the Deck," I listen to you articulate your impatience with our sorry state of affairs, unsure if I was part of the solution or piling more wood onto the fire. Memories clumsy, so much left out, so many subtle add-ins. Coming out of an underpass, I spied a billboard that for a second read, "We Generous," before blinking and seeing what the words actually said. "We've got to find a way," Marvin crooned, "to bring some love in here today. But how? What we? And how generous?" There was something about that crowded table of young musicians, in between sets, cordoned off by invisible rope, that haunts me. Is it they didn't look over once at us all night? That's not it. Any circle worth its form curls inward, a spring about to unfurl in a snap. It was too loud to talk anyway. Two brotherhoods convening for a night. Can you even call such proximity a meeting? The way a man and a woman share a smoke outside a club, not knowing what to do with the plenitude of loneliness, except refrain from offering some of its sweetness to one another? Somewhere dead center inside the second set, I'm ready to scream or get the hell out. To place the album cover street, to pace the album cover street, wrapped in drizzle, yearning for something to breathe my sweet blue self back into, when David leans in, mouth in my ear, why does sabotage always answer its own urgent question by blowing things up? I shout my retort, there is no melody in the world worth this much chasing. But at the last possible moment, the baritone grabs hold of funky R&B riff and rides its steamboat current to the night's horizon, bobbing lovingly in its wake, taking all of us left right along with him. And I see the woman behind the bar, allow the rhythm carry her into the grooves of her habitual chores as the man on his way to the John falls easily into its rutted sway. Couple more poems and I'll be done. I often write from looking at photographs, and this is a photograph taken by the great bassist Milt Hinton. And let me just... What was the song? Yeah, Coltrane. Stardust. Oh, I love that song. But yeah, you got it, Coltrane, the man. This is a picture of Dizzy Gillespie as a young man. And a student of mine gave me this title. We fall into shapes and breathe deeply. A young musician asleep on a train, already famous or soon will be. You strain to see, don't want to be rude. Face open, innocent, he sleeps like a boy, full weight on his elbows. And though there is no way to know this, you are sure he has no change in his pockets. Old bandmates or devotees picking him up at the station to deliver him to his next meal. You should keep moving, not block the aisle, but you want the light to fall like this always in the dark room of trains, to slant across the expanse of his face, eyes closed as if by tender fingers, mouth slightly open. You want to place a coin on his lips in homage to all the music that will blossom there. This last poem I wrote in New Orleans a couple years before Katrina, and it's dedicated to the poet Sasha Feinstein. And tonight I'm going to dedicate it to Jen, because thank you so much for that introduction. And Terry, thanks for having me, and it's great to be back here. Thanks for coming out. What love is. You could tell he was Marsalis' brother, even sitting in the back. He had that muddy river lilt in his voice, the bristling intellect, and the irrepressible need to teach the storied history of African-American classical music. Jazz was in his blood as legacy. The funky butt was jammed, only this back table free, whiskey's on the way. A bassy number, Monk, the band tight, Delfeo's trombone aflame from the opening chorus. I even didn't mind that nearby tables were more chatter than rapt attention, or that our waitress took her time. For Delfeo was holding forth on the subject of cutting, that fraternal pissing contest where raw bone skill and bravado run loose to fight for the night's supremacy. When the trumpet got introduced, he looked over at Marsalis, a little reticent to step into the ring. Who could blame him? Delfeo was all over the bone, so low in the register your feet could feel it, so high he was bumping the night's rafters. And not just range, he donned all the hats of virtuosity in rapid succession and swung like crazy, too. The trumpeter was game, following behind like a younger brother, tossing up the bell of his horn, blatting out wild roundhouse notes. But he was going down. And when he managed a high C and held it, it came from his waist. He'd been cut off at the legs. We nearly jumped out of our seats like at some cellar cockfight. At the break, heading for the John, I spied a couple groping in the dark hall, the woman pushing the man up against a wall, kissing him hard, his hand cupping her ass. And when the waitress set down our drinks, her breast dropping like ripe peaches, a cowgirl tattoo dancing on her arm, I just about burst into happiness for being among friends, for loving my wife, who I knew was at home in front of the fire, dog asleep at her feet, and raised a silent toast to the night unfolding, to soulful music, and to the graceful glance of good luck's passing. Later, when Del Feo plays the loveliest solo on You Don't Know What Love Is I Ever Heard, heroin slow, each note laid out like an early morning baker sets out a rack of bread loaves. The place gets church quiet, drinks clinking as we listen in on a one-way lover's plea into the grimy payphone of the blues. Before we leave, the couple returns, the guy's shirt back basted with brick dust and sweat. I shake Marsalis's hand on the way out in that tentative way blacks and whites do, half soul shake, half how you do, and tell him what I think of his solo. He gives me a look I can't read that I like to think registered surprise. What do I know? Out on the street, on the walk back to the hotel, past a broken, bottled Congo square, the four of us picked our way through the drunks, city still bustling past midnight, sidewalks slick from a street sweep of rain, jabbering about the prize fight of a set, and I tried to tell my friends something of the feeling that had taken hold of me, stumbling over the words like a greenhorn sitting in. He listened, rapt, happy, filling in the last gap of my music with a huge whoop, and then steps later, wow, wow, as we crossed over onto canal, heads bent in reverie for all the night had offered up in its swell. Thank you so much. I got one more song for you, and I can't help it. I got to put it on.
This is WPVM 103.5 FM in Asheville, North Carolina, and you're listening to Wordplay. We've been listening to Sebastian Matthews reading at UNC Greensboro earlier this year from his book We Generous. And now we're going to listen to a selection by Dick Barnes, one of Sebastian's teachers, reading and singing just a few months before his death. So here's Dick Barnes.
In the late 60s, Jim Bogan and Mike Fay lived next to each other almost on 12th Street. They got the idea that they could play a little music at noon and clarinet and banjo. I think Eric Rosenau played the trombone a little while too. But then they recruited me to play the washboard, which is a wonderful opportunity I'll never be grateful enough for. After we've been performing for, about pretty near 20 years, always in front of an audience, we never rehearsed any songs, since people didn't really hear what I said anyway, because I didn't start out with a microphone or anything. I make them up in front of the audience and gradually shake them out until they got to be what I wanted, if I could remember. So in 1990, I made a collection called the Real-Time Jazz Band Songbook, which is a compilations of the songs I had at that time, plus some stories about things that musicians do and say, and some poems I wrote about the procedures of music. And so I think I'll just encode some of that book onto this CD. It's dedicated to my wife, Pat. Ruby, my dear, like the red flush in the east when morning is near and deep purple fades and glory is about to appear in early gold on tip of peak at sunup. Ruby, my dear. She knows exactly what that means. And I hope nobody else does. First song, see if I can get the bridge right. Put all my eggs in one basket, leaving all my loving up to you. Then I set that basket on your doorstep, finding out what you intend to do. It stayed there all night, till the break of day, when the milkman came and took it away. And now I have no eggs and no basket, which is leaving me with nothing but the blues. Some call the Bear House Blues. Has first and last verses are traditional, but the rest are all my own work. Don't the moon seem lonesome shining through the trees? Don't the moon seem lonesome shining through the trees? Don't your house look empty when your woman packs and leaves? Baby, please don't leave me. If you go, what shall I do? Baby, please don't leave me. If you go, what shall I do? She said, I tried so hard, but I just can't live with you. She took the TV, the car, and the radio. Yeah, she took the TV, the car, and the radio. Paper keeps coming, but I think I'll let it go. Baby, if you were trying, I was trying too. Baby, if you were trying, I was trying too. She said, you did your best, that's why I'm leaving you. And she took the table, the desk, and the rocking chair. She took the table, the desk, and the rocking chair. Every place I look, this old house looks mean and bare. Baby, how can you do it when you know I love you so? Baby, how can you do it when you know I love you so? She said, it's been nice talking, but I see it's time to go. Don't the moon seem lonesome shining through the trees? Don't the moon seem lonesome shining through the trees? Don't your house look empty when your woman packs and leaves? Another blues called the Better Not Shout. I composed it one time in a fit of anger and disgust about Christmas. Christmas was so lavish. I like it to be sort of frugal. And my son Henry was here, so he was belting out something on the piano. And I made up this lyric, which I thought was sort of said how I felt about Christmas. And my dad, he dug it because he feels the same way about Christmas. And my mother sweetly dug it too because she thought it was so nice that we were playing together. And she didn't usually pay much attention to the words. Well, you better not shout, be careful about your hair. Better not shout, be sure you comb your hair. Because Santa Claus is coming and his spies are everywhere. He knows when you're sleeping, knows when you're awake. He even knows when you're sleeping, he knows when you're awake. He knows how good you are, so be good for goodness sake. He's got a bucket on a corner and a throne and a department store. He's got a bucket and a corner and a stone and a throne and a department store. And he's walking all in red, so there's a big fat ho, ho, ho. You're making a list, you even check it twice. You're down on Santa's list and he's even gonna check it twice. Little kids won't get no presents. There's Santa Claus that they decides that they've been nice. Well, we got too many presents. We all ate too much food. We got too many presents. We all ate too much food. I was glad when New Year's came, so I wouldn't have to be so good. Should be clear that most of these tunes originate with someone else and other lyrics. The only original tunes in the whole book are Bust Them, I Ask for Nothing that I wrote and the Whiff song that Jim Bogan wrote. But the lyrics are what's new. The Blue Room was a real place in Pasadena the late 60s, early 70s. Sculptor and his lady friend kept it, and it was pretty much as described. The Blue Room. Well, the Blue Room, the new room, our own tea for two room. That's what I'm thinking about, climbing up the stairs with you. Life can be magic on big sheets of plastic, slipping around in Wesson oil, starting a trend with you. Every time I think about those times that we met, oh, I'll never regret, no, at least I haven't yet. So after the laughter goes up to the rafters, grooving on the residue when I've been up there with you. Well, a black light, a strobe light, a won't you disrobe light, smoke bombs and chicken down, state of the art with you. Not your man nor your daddy, your name for your city. Matrimonial politics keep up to date with you. Every time I think about those times that we met, oh, I never regret, no, at least I haven't yet. So after the laughter goes up to the rafters, grooving on the residue when I've been up there with you. No secret, that was Judy Gurwitz. She decided she didn't want to be named after her husband, Lloyd Hamrell. But Gurwitz was her daddy's name too, so she called herself Judy Chicago. Here's a pretty old one. It goes way back to King Oliver. It's a trio of a longer piece, Buddy's Habits. Down by the hen house, out by the barn, little piles of sawdust, odd strands of yarn, bits of fur and feathers, stray snots of glue. Buddy has his habits, just the same as me and you. First was a rabbit, then was an owl, then was a hound dog, Buddy's sick of hearing him howl. Then he stuffed his mama and started on the guests. Take a shower in Buddy's motel, and you may be the next. Here's one called The Hot Tamale Man that's included on a record. I forget the name of the banjo player, very talented banjo player and singer with Tom Sharpstein up in Orland, California. And Tom Sharpstein and his Orlandos. But he took it from the book, so it's on a CD now. I'm that famous. I wish I'd been able to tell him that the tamales is something that I collected in the street in Hermosillo, Sonora in the 50s. A little piece of melody that you wouldn't naturally get from the songbook or from the Freddie Keppard recording of it way back in the early days. Tamalada de mi corazón, la serenata en el malecón. Tamales, hay hot tamales, man. El mar y la brisa tropical, yo me enchilé con un tamal. Tamales, hot tamales, man. Sinaloa, Nayarit, Jalisco, Veracruz, Tamaulipas, Tabasco. Por donde quiera que yo me vaya, mi tamalada nunca me falla. Tamales, hot tamales, man. South of the border down in old Mexico, you can't find very much jelly roll. You're going to try them hot tamales, man. Wrapped in husks of corn or banana leaves, they'll stuff them most any way you please. You're going to like them hot tamales, man. You like them hot. They got a lot of salsa. Special treat that can't be beat, panocha. When you get back to Gringo Land, that jelly roll seems kind of bland. You're dreaming about them hot tamales, man. Here's one that came true. I want a little girl. Well, it's an awful thing, the way I feel. Maybe it's something that time could heal. Or if a little girl should fall in love with me. Yesterday, tomorrow too, don't seem to matter what I try to do. But a loving little girl might suit me to a T. I don't care about her hair or where she wears her clothes. A love that's true follows through, must come to me, I know. So I'm looking around, I'm sure to find what I need to satisfy my mind. I want a little girl to fall in love with me. It's an awful thing to feel this way. That's why I hang out at Misty's, to say I want a little girl that falls in love with me. Yesterday, tomorrow too, never seems to matter what I try to do, but a loving little girl might suit me to a T. She may not be the kind you see spread out in a picture book, but if she can cook, she'll be fine with me. I get used to how she looks. So I'm looking around, sure to find what I need to satisfy my mind. I want a little girl to fall in love with me. And Jelly Bean Blues, just the trio section, has an epigraph, if you want, adapted from Wallace Stevens. Among 20 snowy mountains, the only spot of color was one jelly bean. I could sit right here and dream 1,000 miles away, when my jelly bean dreamed be of them jelly beans of yesterday. See, right on. Look here what you done. You went and made me love you. Now your jelly bean done come. She's Alabama bound. She done left me behind with one jelly bean to satisfy my mind. 219 train took my sweetie away. Jelly bean, bring her back someday. Oh, Frankie Doozan, I thought I heard him shout, give me a jelly bean, gal, I gotta beat it out. I mean, give me a jelly bean like I explain ya. People familiar with J. Roll Martin's Library of Congress recordings will no doubt have a pleasure of recognition. This one, too, is sort of starts out like Jelly. And his introduction to Mamie's Blues, which I use as a tune for J.R. Cooley Blues. Well, this is the first blues I no doubt wrote in my life. J.R. Cooley used to be a man of parts around these parts, but he ran into some bad luck in Texas, and a terrible thing happened to him right here in Claremont. So to sort of pacify him, I made a song about it, and the words that went about like this. Well, he knocked on the door. He saw that door was black. He knocked on the door. Big old door was black. He'd been there before, but he had to come on back. He said, please, Miss Susan, do you have a painting for me? Oh, please, Miss Susan Lautman, don't you have a painting for me? I gotta make my start in the movie industry. She said, J.R., what you doing around here? Miss J.R. Cooley, why you come around here? If it's a painting you want, take the one you stole last year. Well, his teeth were yellow. His beard was black. Snaggly teeth were yellow. Bushy beard was black. He'd been there before, but he had to come on back. Don't know if I can do this one without with or without the band. So. This love song of the Nile. Drifting on the Nile. Watch for the crocodile. Hares change to snakes in the mud. Beetles breed from hippopotamus blood. In the bulrushes, there's a baby. Take him home, he'll mess with your daddy. Seven plagues come down in a while, part of the love song of the Nile. Her barge burned on the water, not a stitch on the Pharaoh's daughter. Union pearls dissolved in your wine. Divers hook live fish on your line. Then till seaward with a bell went the god who loved him so well. But he had to admit it was fun for a while singing the love song of the Nile. Pliny, Plutarch, Shakespeare, Exodus. There, learn a little piece.
This is WPVM 103.5, Asheville, North Carolina, and that's Wordplay for this week. We've been listening to Sebastian Matthews and Dick Barnes. We hope you'll join us again next week. Sometimes you'll find more information on the web at wordplayradio.blogspot.com. Wordplay is produced in the studios of WPVM in downtown Asheville. Our theme is by Jeffrey Keezer, and it's the title track from his CD, Falling Up. And right now we're listening to another track from the same CD, The Horsewoman. Wordplay is available throughout the week from the archive page of WPVM.org. And while you're there, check out the new program schedule. So, till next week, catch you later.